somehow or the other, economics is tied up with ethics. One of the volumes, one of the initial six volumes, was on this topic, the social responsibility of corporations. And they got a very distinguished Christian layman and an economist, who later became a college president, another great thing. They got him to write a book on it. Now, this was 1952. Well, the doctrine's been around. Recently, however, it's enjoyed a tremendous resurgence. And I'm very glad about that. I'm glad it's the cat out of the bag. I think the doctrine of corporate social responsibility is 50% nonsense, and the other 50% is dangerous. I'm against it, thoroughly. But I love the fact that more and more people are preaching it now, because since I've written a book on it, that makes me a sort of expert, and I get invited around to various places to come and refute it. Because when I try, that I get booed. You know, well, they're not booed. They can't quite figure this out. A guy with a beard is expected to come in and preach things like corporate social responsibility. I'm supposed to lay down the law to all these corporation executives, tell them that they are sinning and they must shape up. And to get ahead of the story a little bit, that's what they want to hear. They like to hear that they're sinning, because then they can say, yes, indeed, we have sinned. Meaning, of course, all those other guys. But I myself am fulfilling my social responsibilities, and they want to be justified, I think, by their good work. But it's nice. I got to go down to Acapulco last January to tell some businessmen that they shouldn't be socially responsible, and to get paid and a nice 3-day vacation in Acapulco. For telling people to be irresponsible, that's... but what has happened in the last 4 or 5 years is that there's been a resurgence of interest in this doctrine because of a number of things, primarily concerned with the environment. And a lot of people have decided that if corporations will just assume their social responsibility, we'll be able to resolve our environmental problems. But there are three other issues that keep cropping up that I keep running into. The second one now is the issue of employment policies, especially with respect to minority races and now women. A lot of people are, well, you take the biggest project going on today is the so-called Project for Corporate Responsibility. If you haven't heard that term, I'm sure you have in your newspapers read something about their activities. They operate out of Washington, D.C. They're tied in with Ralph Nader. I'm sure you don't remember the names of these people, but they are responsible for Campaign GM. No, doesn't ring any bells. Campaign GM was this campaign that's been going on now for 3 years. They go to the meetings,
General Motors meetings, and try to get
General Motors to pass certain resolutions, try to get the shareholders to pass certain resolutions that will compel General Motors to adopt particular policies with respect to the hiring of minorities, adopt particular environmental policies, pull out of South Africa. And in the last year, this attracted additional attention within church circles because a number of church groups decided to throw their weight behind Campaign GM, and they supported the Project for Corporate Responsibility. The employment policies is an issue. Another one is the Vietnam War. And there's a good deal of, and this is a big, tricky issue in itself, but a lot of people seem to feel that corporations that are socially responsible will not produce military hardware of any sort. I don't want to get into that. Not now. Maybe we can on Wednesday and wind this up. But you should be aware of that fact. One person who feels that way, I think, is my wife. Julie, are you... She doesn't come when I talk about this because it makes her furious. But a number of church bodies, again, are recommending, they're recommending to their investment counselors that they divest themselves of all stocks in their portfolios, which are the stocks of corporations that produce bombs, planes, tanks, bullets. Sometimes they focus on anti-personnel weapons. Sometimes they don't. But the war. the whole war, their notion that there are some corporations that are supporting the war, and that they ought not to do this, that it is their social responsibility not to support the war. This idea is catching on. And then, of course, there's a lot of interest just in the overseas operations of American corporations because of the growing prominence of the idea that American corporations are largely responsible for the mess the world is in. And that's a big, complicated bag, too. But I don't want to get into all those various kinds. I think we can be a little safer if we just focus on the first of these two issues. And I'm not even going to focus on them. I want to focus on the doctrine itself. But if you find it a little bit vague, and you wonder, what does he mean by social responsibility? What are people urging when they're urging corporations to be socially responsible? Think of it this way. They're urging them, these are the two big ones, to be responsible in their use of the environment, and not to muss
up the ecology. Not to dump in the rivers and things like that. Not to make automobiles that are unsafe at any speed. Part of the environmental problem, you get dead
bodies all over the highway. And the other thing is to adopt employment policies that do not discriminate against women and minority races.
We'll just let those things stand for
social responsibility. Now, maybe you think it's obvious that corporations ought to be socially responsible, but I find it a very strange claim. As I said, we should all be socially responsible, but why should corporations be peculiarly socially responsible? Why should books and articles in the Harvard Business Review, and the Harvard Business Review is loaded with them, why should they be appearing,
urging businessmen to do this?
Why should businessmen be gathering together in solemn seminars, and they do, to talk about their social responsibilities? Why should corporation executives, and I mean the presidents and chairmen of the board of the biggest corporations, be making all of these speeches that the
National Life Underwriters
Association and the Worldwide Kiwanis Coffee Clutch or whatever they do? They're reported in the Wall Street Journal. You see them. They say
things like,
unless corporations today assume their social responsibilities, the world will go to some kind of hell in a bushel basket. Read
the editorial page
of the Wall Street Journal. At least once a week,
somebody is
sounding forth on that topic. Now, I find that a strange claim, because nobody's saying that about me. Nobody's saying it about churches. Nobody's saying it about, interestingly, nobody's saying it about the government. When was the last time you heard someone say, unless the President of the United States assumes his social responsibility? We all assume he is, don't we? Do we assume that the President has an interest in being socially responsible?
Does that imply that we assume that corporation executives have an interest in being socially irresponsible?
The answer is, most people
do make that assumption. The assumption that is running just
below the surface in most thinking and talking about this issue is that the executives of business corporations have a personal interest in being socially irresponsible. You think so?
I'm getting you.
Yeah, say that again. I lost you.
All right.
The assumption is that the executives of large
business corporations
have an interest in being socially irresponsible. Not thoroughly socially irresponsible, but slightly, or somewhat, or significantly irresponsible. In other words, if they did what it is in their own private interest to do, it'd be bad for the country. That's the assumption. A lot of people are making. I just wondered whether you thought about that or whether you accept it.
I think the main reason a person goes into business is to make a profit.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think a person would go into business unless he's a unique person. But not, for something other than that. I think it's
a most part. No. As I wandered around listening in, because I didn't have a chance to follow any of the discussions through, but everybody was talking about something different. I didn't hear the same topic twice. And I got around some of the groups more than once. And they had changed by the time I came around the second time. Which indicates that, it was clear on the part of some people there was a good deal of concern about this problem, but the concern went in all kinds of directions. For example, I did hear in one group some concern that corporations not only didn't have power, but the belief that they did have a lot of power was cause for serious concern. I came in with a number of pieces of paper, you see, which involved different approaches, and which approach I took was going to depend on what I heard. But I'm still not sure. Listen, anybody come up with anything really earth-shaking? Is there a problem? There's a problem.
Corporations have that power if they go to another country and do the same thing over there cheaper, and loosening the labor force here, cut back the labor force. That isn't a threatening thing to our
Now, what's threatening? The Hartke bill?
Not the Hartke bill, but the corporations have this very process, who get it out for the very things of the profit about the
he's one of the, it's the Burke Hartke bill, isn't it? Yeah. I think that's one of the worst pieces of legislation that's been come up with in the last 15 years, but that's interesting. Maybe we can get into that. I'd rather not get into that right away because it involves some complicated questions in international economics. But maybe we can.
We were talking about size. I heard something going on in our group about the size of corporations and how that great size may inhibit their responsiveness or slow it down or or limit.
Let me try something here that I think will be useful. You got to get a handle on this problem. You can talk endlessly and we can all go out of here more confused than we came in. And that's not necessarily bad, Where an issue is confused or confusing, it's good to be confused. Oversimplifications are a great danger in this sinful world. The question, how much power do corporations have? Is that different from the question, how much power do corporation managers have? Don't answer right away. Think about that. How much power do corporations have? How much power do corporation managers have?
Tell me what you mean by manager.
Yeah. Well, I mean the executive officers. Yeah. The managers of our large corporations. The president, the chairman of the board, and maybe one or two others. It varies. Are those different questions?
No, I don't think they're different questions really, but I think that the way that they're perceived by the public may differ. Because if President Joe Doe of General Motors says something as President Joe Doe, that carries a certain weight because of his office and his prestige. But if General Motors does something, they innovate a new policy or a procedure or something like that, I think that it's received differently by the public because of the massive size and stature of General Motors.
Mm-hmm.
There are many cases where a president or a chairman of the board will have one policy, and a corporation generally will have another. Mm-hmm. You might need the difference between out of control of the executive office having a corporation.
Well, I'm thinking of the executive officers or the management as that group which does have control, which sets the policy of the corporation. The question, I can't see how the two questions are different. I agree with you. I mean, to talk about, remember I said something yesterday about this kind of a personification of the corporation as if corporations make decisions, Here are all these people who work for General Motors, including the president, and can go, "My God, look what the corporation has done to us."
It is people who are making these decisions, and unless someone has a serious objection, I'd like to propose that when we talk about the power of corporations, we should be talking about the power of corporate managers, the executives. Now, I think that we trap ourselves sometimes by this habit of personification, that we create ogres in our society, inhuman or superhuman forces that are getting us. We do this sometimes with things like technology, the modern age, science. Some people like that. It instills in them a healthy sense of terror, and they delight in being terrified. The conspiracy myth is very, very popular. It's nice to feel that there's a group out there or a force that is rolling relentlessly over us. Yeah.
But many an executive body of common sense where they want to change or direct a corporation in a particular line and find it tremendously hard, frustrating, and give up trying to do so simply because of the vastness of the machinery and the other persons under it. So there is, I think,
all right, but now, who's got the control? Well, what are you? If you now talk about the power of the corporation, what are you talking about? You're saying that corporate managers can't always do what they want to do. Then what is it that's constraining them? Is it the power of the corporation that is constraining them? Or is it just the ordinary problems of getting anything organized effectively? Huh?
Subletted authority.
All right,
because
but
all the authority is not even
okay.
Even though they are a prime authority.
All right, I'd like you to think for a moment about the constraints on the power of corporate managers, and you were referring to one of them, the difficulties that they have in persuading their subordinates to cooperate, and for many corporate managers that is a serious problem. I want to run through some of the constraints that operate on corporate managers. And I think it would be helpful for you, you might listen more sympathetically for these next few minutes, if you imagined yourself to be the chief executive officer of some manufacturing corporation. All right? Now, I think as soon as you do that, you see the world a little differently. Suppose that you're the chief executive officer of the pick some corporation you know a little bit about. Everybody knows a little bit about something different. And now I'll ask yourself, are you not constrained by, in the first instance, concern for the price of the stock? Why? Well, in the first place, that's sort of the gold star measure of your performance. Even if it didn't mean anything financially, if it didn't mean anything in terms of your job security, just like that little gold star that your mommy used to put on the wall when you brushed your teeth didn't really mean anything in terms of cookies and milk. Still, you wanted it, darn it. You want to be first in the class rather than third. And people are this way. You want to be thought well of. You want people to say, good job, well done, old chap. And so the price of the stock is, for corporate managers, a gold star measure. And they're very, very concerned about that. But they're concerned with the price of the stock for other reasons. How much these reasons operate is going to vary from manager to manager, corporation to corporation. Sometimes it's because of a concern for their own wealth. If the corporate manager is a substantial owner of the stock, he's concerned about his wealth. Another thing, the price of the stock significantly affects the ability of corporate management to raise capital. Short-term as well as long-term. You see, if the price of the stock is high, that means you can float a new stock issue and raise a lot of money. If the price of the stock is low, that means people aren't too keen on owning a piece of your corporation. That means they're not going to pay a lot of money to own a piece of your corporation, which means you can have trouble raising funds. And if the price of your stock is low or falling, banks and other short-term lenders aren't too eager to loan you money either. Well, now, if you remember that the way in which a corporate manager secures the power to do whatever it is he wants to do, good or bad, is through securing funds, then obviously the corporate manager who is concerned with his own power of action has to be concerned about the price of his stock. I mentioned yesterday the problem of raiders, corporate raiders, and there are a bunch of professionals floating around. And if the price of a stock goes low because of faulty management, because you made a boo-boo of some sort, that is an open invitation to some of these corporate raiders to slip in, buy a big chunk of this stock, and turn you into a former corporation executive. And it's, you know, it's pretty hard to get a job with comparable salary after you've been president of a large corporation. And there is also the danger of internal coups if the price of that stock falls. That stock price is also looked at within the large corporation as an indicator of success for management. When management performs poorly and the stock price goes down, it's talked about inside the corporation. And there are a lot of people who say, you know, I could do a lot better than old Charlie up there. It's interesting, we know very little about how corporate managements change. You pick up the newspaper and you suddenly read that General Motors announced today. It's always said that General Motors announced today. You wonder what the general was wearing when he made the announcement. So-and-so is now the chairman of the board, so-and-so is now the president. And they actually shift the titles, okay? They will change titles as well as slotting new individuals in those titles. And you wonder, you know, it's a relatively small number of men, but who's in that group? Who's making those decisions? How do they decide that? But there's some process within every corporation. Burley may be right. It's an automatic, self-perpetuating oligarchy, but it isn't one individual who's just free to do whatever he wants to do, and if he goofs, he's still got the power to hang on to his position. All right, besides the stock price, which affects corporate managers in all of these ways, they have to be concerned about labor unions, which I heard some of you mention. That's a constraint on their power. They have to also be concerned about their labor force if it isn't unionized. If you don't provide an adequate wage, decent working conditions, whatever that means, it means at least competitive wages and competitive working conditions, you're going to have trouble attracting and keeping a labor force. Until quite recently, corporate managers had to be very concerned about middle management satisfaction. If the guys down at the middle, who have a great deal to do with the success of the corporation and its day-by-day operations, are disgruntled, they tend to go off to a competitor, sometimes carrying along some of your favorite secrets. Now today that isn't too much of a concern because the market for middle managers is a little weak. Very important item, and as I listen to some of you, I don't think some of you agree that it's an important item, is simply consumer fickleness. You don't agree that's important?
Oh, I'm agreeing with you, yes. Oh,
yeah. You know, we think that corporations, they decide to produce left-handed gizmos. Now, nobody wants a left-handed gizmo, but they immediately launch a vast advertising campaign, and before you know it, our egos are all tied up with left-handed gizmos and we're all compulsively slavering after one. Maybe corporations, through their advertising, do us in to some extent in this fashion. But from the standpoint now of the corporation executive, the consumer is terribly fickle. I don't know how to prove this to you. I'm convinced of it partly by reasoning myself into the position of these guys, partly by the little experience with business that I've had, partly by reading the experience of corporate managers, and just partly by being aware of the extraordinary fickleness of individuals. A store, a supermarket, can be doing a fantastic business 1 year and be going bankrupt the next year. Why? And you investigate, it's almost impossible to find out. And then it turns out that the store next door put in stamps. And they didn't. Or the store next door abolished stamps, and they didn't. And you just don't know. The word gets around, your produce is spongy. and boom, you're gone. The I have a friend in the advertising business. He says others have this same sign up, but he still keeps a sign on his office wall called Remember the Edsel. You know what happened to the Edsel? Nobody's quite sure what happened to the Edsel, but one of the things that happened was there's a bad report in Consumer Reports. Consumer Reports picked up a couple of bad Edsels, and $350 million investment was wiped out. How many little, just tiny little shifts in consumer opinion are sufficient to make the difference between a profit and a loss? You see, business firms gear up for an anticipated level of output. And so, you know, go back to these left-handed gizmos that nobody needs. Still, once the corporation has psyched us into believing that we need them, they are dependent upon our continued consumption of left-handed gizmos at a rather high rate. And they've got to be very, very concerned that somebody doesn't come up with a right-handed gizmo that does a better job. So they are deeply concerned with product improvement. We sometimes think that, well, they're not the least bit worried about quality and product improvement. All they're interested in is image. Well, they are interested in image, but one of the reasons they're interested in image is because they're so concerned that you be aware of every little jot and tittle in the quality of their product. Okay, they also got to be concerned about other firms in their industry, obviously. They've got to be concerned in addition about other firms not in their industry. And for two reasons. Those other firms not in their industry are competitors and potential competitors. They are competitors, for example, in factor markets. That is to say, they are also buying labor and other inputs. You have to be concerned about what other competitors, what other firms in your area are paying the labor force. You've got to be concerned what other firms, not even in your area, are paying executives and middle managers and engineers. You've got to be competitive. Today, with so many firms so diversified, it's become increasingly easy for large corporations to move into new product areas. And many corporation executives worry at night that some firm like International Gumball is going to suddenly go into toilet tissue manufacture. And my gosh, you know, if they come in here in our area where we now control 22% of the market, they'll probably grab 3% in the first year, and that'll knock us down to about 20 because 2% of that'll come off of us, and that's the difference between a profit and a loss. And if you don't think that those little percentages make the difference between a profit and a loss, you're wrong. They do. Government regulatory agencies. And don't just think of the federal government here. Government regulatory agencies all the way from the municipal fire inspector, who might be your chief pain in the neck. There are all sorts of little local regulations. Now, granted, often local regulations aren't enforced against giant corporations. On the other hand, sometimes they're enforced in a very discriminatory way against large corporations because of something that I heard someone over here talking about. Oh, that guy was you. The sort of small business mentality of many Americans, that big business is bad. We just know it's bad. They're trying to take us over so you don't patronize Penny's and Montgomery Ward's and Sears. You patronize your local independent druggist, you know. That mentality, which is very, very strong in certain parts of the Midwest. You take an area running from the Appalachians to the Rockies, just about, and it sort of rules. It's the territory of William Jennings Bryan. Even down in Texas, where you got to call yourself a conservative to be elected to any political office, you can still hate big business and be a conservative. Just be a populist.
Just before we left home, the Department of Environmental Quality completely shut down a large paper mill in our hometown because of pollution. Put 600 people out of work and probably affected 2,500 people altogether.
Where is this?
In Salem, Oregon.
Salem, Oregon. Yeah. There was a group.
They just shut them down.
There was a group over there talking about that.
They'd spent some $6.5 million to curb their pollution, and but they were still putting out something like 10 times the amount of emissions that they were supposed to. Just close the door.
So the firms have to be concerned about regulatory commission decisions of this sort, which may be fairly applied and may be unfairly applied. Now, I want to stress that. There is an awful lot of scope for arbitrary decision in most government regulations. Carol was talking about that the other day with respect to the Forest Service. Holden Village suffers from that. Anybody who deals with a government bureaucracy has to worry about that. And that means, of course, you've not only got to know what the rules are, hire a lawyer to keep you abreast of all of the changing rules and regulations, but you'd better also look like a good guy. Stay on the good side of the right people, whoever they are. You know. And sometimes you don't even know who they are.
600 people thrown out of work. What did they think about the solution problem?
They marched on the Capitol.
Yeah, interesting enough, they marched on the Capitol rather than on the employer.
Well, why not? The employer wanted to keep operating. The Capitol was the place to march, wasn't it?
Still, he could make adjustments and changes that would control the pollution if they were pumping the air.
Well, why didn't he then?
He's going to know.
$6.5 million he spent, and they just haven't been able to bring it under control.
They haven't been able to. They didn't want to. It sounds like they didn't want to. If he can do it now.
Well, I think the problem is they keep saying that they can, but they don't. Well, they've been saying for a year's time that they could bring this under control, but they just don't. They haven't been able to.
Up to a part of the state commission will commit to operate something.
We've been in a situation, too, where the same identical regulations, but they keep increasing
where are
you regulations
from?
This kind of stuff. Where they keep increasing the regulations. So you meet up with the regulations, and 2 years later, you're below the regulations. So you have to go one step further, and it costs you getting it out. Just can't operate in competition with Southern mills that are not doing the same thing at the same time.
Well, the point is this.
Right.
Yeah, the point is it's just another thing that these managers have to worry about, and this is a big worry to them. They have to completely shut down their plant.
That's like in my area, as farmers, you know. Every single year, if you want to stay in grade enough, you got to do something different. Like, that come around 1 year and says all doors have to swing out, and he gave him a good reason. Next year he come around and says all your doors have to swing in.
Well, I wanted to just mention one other item and then pose a question. Corporate managers, in my experience, are also very concerned with being well thought of. They just want to be known as good guys, as we all do. And I think this explains a good deal of their social responsibility. Like, they assign some poor schluck to serve for the year on the United Fund. That poor schluck will get no credit, but I, as president of the corporation, will probably receive the Joe B. Hornfellow Award for Outstanding Citizen of the Year. In view now of all of these constraints and others, which I may not have thought of, like your wife, I mentioned that. Yeah. I can't tell this story. I'll tell you a story later about how wives exerted pressure on the corporate power structure of Atlanta, Georgia, sometime, but it's not the mixed company. Now you're all curious.
Yeah.
Willie Hertzfeld will tell you the story. In view of all these constraints, how much power does this leave corporate managers to set wages? Well, no, I don't want to run away from the wife thing. Look, when a corporate manager, if he's married, has a family, he goes home, and there's some issue in which his corporation is involved, doesn't he care what his children think of him, what his wife thinks of him? Doesn't he care what the community right there thinks of him? Does he want to be known as the president of a, of a polluting company? He does not. Kids go to school and they have their civics lesson, and Daddy's corporation is hauled out as the, this happens. You've got to remember, corporation executives are people who live in communities, who have wives and children, who work in the community, and they are...
Like, was in Minneapolis, even some grade school kids, kind of made a mistake or something, then anyway, they figured out a polluter of the month. That really got in the front page. The polluter of the month this month is, you know,
All right, now, in view of all of these constraints, how much power do corporate managers have to set wages, set prices, determine the product, determine the quality of the product, clean up the environment, and usher in an era of social junk?
Are those attracting the power?
Well, no, but these are things that corporate managers have been accused of doing irresponsibly are things I've listed. They're setting low exploitative wages. They're setting high discriminatory prices. They're determining the product. They're producing things we don't want. They're determining the quality of the product. They're producing shabby, shoddy merchandise and ramming it down our throats. But now they're supposed to clean up the environment. They're supposed to usher in an era of social or racial justice, at least. I've just listed six things here that corporate managers are accused of doing wrongly. My question is, in view of the constraints operating on them, how much power do they have to do differently?
I don't think they have much power to do this.
I don't think they have much either. I don't think that corporate managers have many degrees of freedom in our society. And since I can't distinguish between corporate managers and corporations, really. When I talk about the power of corporations, I'm talking about the degrees of freedom of corporate managers. I have come, right now, to the very unusual conclusion that corporations don't have much power. Okay. You want to take a particular corporation and look at that now? Take U.S. Steel. Okay. Now, suppose that you are the executive officers of United States Steel. From which of these constraints are you free? Let me check here. None.
Are you using freedom and power interchangeably?
Yes.
I would think that the word power might be ascribed to an avalanche. Doesn't have any freedom.
Well, by freedom, by power, I mean the freedom to do what you want to do. By freedom, I mean the power to do what you want to do. Am I being obscure here?
So they seem to have a lot of freedom to vote themselves tremendous salaries and tremendous positions and pensions. It seems to me, which also takes off the cost and percentage of the return.
Okay. All right. I'm glad. Can we take that for just a moment? I agree with you. Why don't you sit here by me? This is one area in which I am concerned about the excessive power of corporate managers, the power to determine their own compensation. Because it seems to me that there are not adequate constraints operating. They do this in excessive secrecy. These constraining or competitive forces that I was talking about operate as collusive forces frequently when the time comes to set compensation. If the executives of U.S. Steel set their wages at $350,000 a year, the executives of Inland Steel are not likely to cut their wages in order to compete. In fact, they're not even likely to call the public's attention to it. In fact, what they will do is say, right indeed, given the extraordinary responsibilities of managing such a vast and complex entity as the corporation, and in the steel business, U.S. Steel is never referred to as U.S. Steel, it's referred to as the corporation. They $350,000 is but a pittance, especially when you consider all the taxes that have to be paid on. And so they'll say, in fact, we at Inland Steel deserve to go up to at least $225,000. You don't have, I think, adequate checks and balances against corporate managers who are fixing their own compensation. One of the things that I would like to see in this area is law, federal law, requiring much clearer publication of information regarding executive compensation. Now, why have the executives fought this? Well, for obvious reasons, but also they claim because the public doesn't understand. They don't understand that it is frequently necessary to pay these seemingly ridiculous salaries in order to attract people who are really worth it. And you know, I can't prove they're wrong on that. I'm convinced, well, and I think I can prove, insofar as anything in this area can be proved, that some corporate managers are vastly overpaid. But then there are some guys who, if you think that the corporate manager's worth is the value that he adds to the company, how much better off is the company as a result of his being there? There are some guys who are worth $1 million a year, at least for 1 year or 2 years. And it makes sense. You know, if there's some hotshot out there who, I feel convinced, if he took over my company, the value of that stock would increase by a big bundle in 1 year, or it would increase by a big bundle the moment he took over because everybody knows he's a hot shot. If I were the owner of that corporation, I'd be willing to pay him a fantastic sum of money to get him, and would be a good investment. And I think what has happened is that a lot of sheer bumbling time servers have come in under the umbrella here and are drawing down these very juicy fringe benefits and salaries. And the fringe benefits have often been a very, very, very important part of the salary because some of them escape taxation. You know, the special parking lot and the executive dining room where you eat crab and lobster for 75 cents and the trip to Acapulco to check on the operation down there, take your wife along to get the woman's touch. That sort of stuff. Okay, so that's an area where corporate managers have, I think, at least excessive power. But that isn't one that most people talk about. When people talk about the power of the corporation, that's not what they're concerned about. They're usually concerned about, in fact, what corporate managers are doing there is defrauding the shareholder. And today, the concern that I encounter anyway, is that corporate managers are doing too well for the shareholder and consequently not well enough for the consumer and the general American working stiff and the public, which has to eat their pollutants.
Now, in General Motors, I like to hire Ralph Nader for a year or so. He's a funds man and he's got public confidence. And my business can be along by General Motors now. Mm-hmm.
I'm sure they would be delighted to hire him. I bet they'd pay a big chunk. Yeah?
The following year, I don't know.
Yeah. He'd turn it down, of course.
Yeah, I'd like to hear that you don't weigh
money in a way. Dialogue or diatribe?
I'm wondering how much. You say there are very little restraints, say like price establishment. And yet, the government ordered that the price rollback a number of times. And yet,
where?
In the area of steel, since we were on U.S. Steel.
Yeah.
This apparently did not too adversely affect any of the corporations, and yet they were free to be able to establish these prices. And if the government had not ordered the rollback, the prices would have stood. Apparently, you know, if a person's competition, and if there's large corporations, and one decides that they're going to up their price by 50%, the other one can feel very perfectly free to up it 49%, and even though it needs
not to do it at all and make that additional profit because he knows the others are going to...
Okay, you're talking about steel, and we agreed to talk about U.S. Steel. Now, be very careful here. U.S. Steel has never upped its prices 50%. They up it 6% or something like that. And they're doing that in a period of inflation when prices of other things are going up too. See, prices of lettuce, bread, tends to go up like sort of like this. But the price of steel, for some very good reasons, tends to go up like this. Now, does the price of steel rise more rapidly than the price of other things? From 1946 to 1960 or 59, the price of steel rose about 30% more rapidly than the price of other things on average. But since 1959, the price of steel has not risen more rapidly than the price of other things. It's risen a little less.
And that's not the point, though. It's not,
well, now, wait a minute.
Whether or not a thing does or does not go up more or greater.
Well, I think
it's
it is.
The concept of whether or not the corporation can up.
All right.
Without the restraints.
Well, but, all right, but now, wait a minute here. Wait a minute. A corporation has the power to raise its prices 6%. That doesn't mean that it operates without constraints. The fact that it operates with constraints is proved by the fact that it didn't raise its price 60% or 12% or even 7%. Very often you will notice, even without government intervention, and government intervention is another constraint, the fear of government intervention is a constraint, the fear of a bad public opinion when the president attacks you on television is a constraint. But corporations, the U.S. Steel has frequently raised its prices and then brought them down a little bit. Shaded here, shaded there. They'll raise a whole battery of prices. Of course, there is no such thing as steel. They sell very different kinds of steel products. They'll raise the prices of some products 6%, 8%, some 2%, some they won't raise at all. They may even cut one or two. Why? Why are they doing that? Because there are different market conditions. They think that the demand relative to the ability of the industry to supply at this time is such that they can get away with an 8% increase. They are aware of the fact that every price increase is dangerous. Every price increase threatens some reduction in the amount that people will purchase because some steel companies may not go along. Because of foreign steel, and because of competition from such products as aluminum, plywood,
glass,
cement. You know, and people say, oh, you can't use plywood to build bridge girders, but of course you can, but steel is used for lots of things besides bridge girders. So they are concerned about this, and I see them as searching all the time for the most profitable price to set, searching in the face of all of these constraints that I've mentioned. When you have a general inflation, the price of sort of everything is going up, including the price of and the demand for things that use steel, then the price-searching executives in U.S. Steel say, I think we could sort of inch up a little bit. I think the demand will support it. I just don't find any evidence in the behavior of prices in the steel industry, at least over the last 15 years, any evidence that U.S. Steel is in a relatively free position. In fact, I'd much rather be the president of most other corporations in Fortune's top 500. I think U.S. Steel executives are extraordinarily constrained. And one bit of evidence to support this is the relatively poor profits of U.S. Steel. U.S. Steel has not done well since World War II. It's been doing poorly relative to the steel industry, and the steel industry has been doing poorly relative to the rest of the economy.
There's a number of steel companies right now on Fortune's loaded laggards list. The loaded laggards are companies whose stock is selling below their book value, which in essence says that you could liquidate the corporation's assets and realize more money than you could by selling it than their stock is worth.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if the people who think of I've claimed some once in print that when people think of the typical American corporation, they think of U.S. Steel and guess what the other one is? General Motors. The two typical U.S. Because they're very, very untypical. But General Motors is a very, very different story from U.S. Steel. It's interesting that these two so-called typical American firms, somebody mentioned IBM. IBM comes up when you want to think of some dynamic, aggressive, future-oriented firm. That's always IBM. Even then you ignore all of the mistakes that IBM has made in recent years. But General Motors would have been a more embarrassing example for me. Embarrassing, that is, if I'm trying to defend the thesis that corporate managers don't have a great deal of power. But let's look at General Motors, because it is the largest manufacturing corporation in the United States. How much power does General Motors have? You know, you have with General Motors a very peculiar constraint, almost a unique constraint. It seems that General Motors could expand its share of the domestic market well beyond its present share, but does not do so for fear of government antitrust action. General Motors is a lower cost producer, all costs considered. That's cost of design, manufacturing, securing public acceptance through advertising, distribution, and all of that. General Motors has it may be in large part a function of General Motors' extraordinarily effective management. I'm inclined to support the thesis that General Motors discovered a better way of management, and it's still in effect. There's a good deal of internal competition within General Motors that I think keeps makes it possible for that firm to achieve the economies of size without achieving the diseconomies of size, which are an unmanageable bureaucracy. But anyway, General Motors probably could cut its prices and force Ford and Chrysler out of business and make more profits. Even in the short run. There's a funny sort of constraint operating there. That's very, very difficult to prove, but there is certainly a lot, their cost data will support it, and the testimony of certain General Motors people off the record will support it too, that they do not cut their prices because they're afraid of the Chevy doing too well over against Plymouth and Ford.
Is that a constraint or collusion?
Well, it's a constraint. In a way, they would, you know, in a world in which if their sole goal was to make as much money for themselves and the corporation as possible, they would cut their prices, drive Ford and Chrysler out of business. What they're afraid of is public reaction and government prosecution. They are so big that they have to walk very, very gingerly. The Sherman Antitrust Act says that it's illegal, first of all, to conspire in restraint of trade, but it also says it's illegal to monopolize. You know, and there's a problem there. In a very important antitrust decision that the largest corporations probably have framed and posted on the wall in the boardroom, or if not, they've committed it to memory, was a decision that Judge Learned Hand delivered in the 1940s with respect to the Aluminum Corporation of America. He noticed that the Aluminum Corporation of America had maintained 100% of the ingot capacity of the United States from shortly after the beginning of the century until World War II. They didn't have it anymore after World War II because the government had built new aluminum plants for military purposes and had then turned them over to new aluminum corporations. But the case was being tried, the case that it had been brought prior to the war. And Judge Learned Hand held with the government that Alcoa had monopolized and thus violated the Sherman Act by always lowering its price sufficiently to capture any new demand that might appear. It had been aggressive in anticipating new demand. You know, and that
Well, what about the problem of monopoly? I'm assuming that, you know, that it would be a problem or is a problem, or, you know, I don't know. I guess I'm asking too.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me, you said corporations can come in and start doing a new thing. You know, the gumball company worries that, or somebody's worried that maybe they're going to spread out into some new area. But surely there are some difficulties in doing that. I mean, it must be very expensive to start producing some new thing. I mean, couldn't monopoly really be a problem? Couldn't it happen? I mean, in some areas, that would be very difficult for somebody to come into an area.
Yeah, it is very difficult to come into certain areas. Automobiles is clearly one. The number of automobile manufacturers in this country has declined rather dramatically in your own lifetime. And since 1920, it's amazing. If you go back and read the history of the automobile industry, you discover how many of them are floating around the time of World War I. There are a few other industries in which this is true, where there seems to be just room for very few. Fortunately, there aren't very many. That's one. There's one, you're saying that's one where there's room for very few, or? Oh, but now wait a minute, there's a difference between saying an individual little businessman can hardly operate and saying that there's only room for very few. There is room in the United States for thousands of supermarkets. There's room in a large city for dozens and dozens of large supermarkets, and that is one of the most competitive businesses in the whole country. And we don't have, be very careful, monopoly doesn't mean size. A&P is a very large corporation. Not only is it not a monopoly, it's not even profitable anymore. It's being waxed by Safeway. Kroger, it wasn't too many years ago that people were saying, A&P and Kroger have the whole grocery industry at their control. They don't. and they not only, they're going down.
It's, small man can't compete against.
Well, no, it's true that you can't, a small man, if he's too small, can't compete. But scattered around the United States are many very wealthy men who went into the grocery business and went into it on a big enough scale that they can compete. People today do not want to buy their groceries, for the most part, in a little mom and pop type grocery store. They want a supermarket. But I don't know. I don't know enough about Seattle or Portland or Minneapolis to know whether there are any locally owned supermarkets. But there are in many cities of the United States. Okay. There are in every city with which I'm familiar. There are locally owned supermarkets that are doing very well. Yeah.
Is it a logical extension of your remarks? Maybe a strong argument for. I hear you saying that there are a whole bunch of constraints on the corporate manager which really prevent him, us, whoever, from holding him accountable. Or the freedom of decision that he has is really constrained by the things that we talked about earlier. Many of those things are attributable to it as a result of a competitive system. Now, if we did away with substantial portions of that competitive system, do we not remove a lot of those constraints and thus to preserve a corporate system as part of our management economy? Are we not then better able to hold individual institutions accountable?
That's a very interesting question. It's sort of the opposite of Keith's question. And it's almost time for the coffee break. And that's a question now of public policy. I'm reasonably satisfied with what's happened this morning. Maybe you feel a little bit frustrated, because I would feel frustrated too if I hadn't long ago gotten over the notion that I got to tell people everything that's in my notes. But I think that you are reflecting on some relationships that maybe you hadn't reflected on before, and that you're no longer quite as convinced as some of you that corporate managers can ride roughshod over us, that they can go anywhere they please. But there is still a lot of concern in this country with monopoly. And the meaning of that word is far from clear. And what I would like to do tomorrow, which is going to be the last session on this, is talk about, briefly, the meaning of monopoly. And show that we define this. This is a Humpty Dumpty word, you know. Words mean what I want them to mean. and there's a great deal of confusion, I believe, that could be avoided if we would eliminate the word monopoly from our vocabulary. I'm going to try to prove to you that it has no useful meaning, and that we ought to substitute whatever it is that we're really talking about. It may be that we're talking about sufficient immunity from these constraints that an individual can behave, quote, responsibly. Remembering, well, You know, remembering that a wheat farm, no one ever tells a wheat farmer to behave in a socially responsible way. You don't talk about the social responsibility of wheat farmers because you recognize that they do not have the degrees of freedom that would enable them to behave in an irresponsible way. They're just sort of hustling, hustling to survive. Period.
Are you going to include patents, the monopoly patents for all?
I might mention that as an instance of the problem with the definition of monopoly. If you think about it, everybody's a monopolist, and nobody's a monopolist. And that is a paradox, and if you understand it, then you don't have to come tomorrow because you can pass the exam.